Which of your films are personal favorites which you feel have been overlooked?
Time is the ally of good films and good writing and good music. You know what I mean? People will discover it over time. Gattaca is a film I'm very proud of that was very much ignored when it came out. I mean, it just came and went and barely got a good review. In fact, I don't think in the United States it got one good review. I think like some small paper in Boston thought it was a good film.
Why do you think that was?
I don't know. You know, the zeitgeist, as you call it, like, is why do people pay attention to Reality Bites and not Gattaca? Why do people love, you know, what they love? I don't know. But time has been the friend of Gattaca. You know, people most often ask me about that.
What do you like so much about Gattaca?
It's a movie that, it's working, you know. So rarely do films use the device of metaphor, you know, or allegory. And Gattaca really does it. And Gattaca was ahead of its time. All this stuff about genetic engineering and all the stuff that's happening now was a little ahead of its time.
Who do you have to be here?
Well, naturally, our standard is beyond that of the common citizen.
Even amongst your people, you must have varying levels of excellence.
Occasionally, we've been forced to accept candidates with minor shortcomings, but nothing that would prohibit someone from working in a field such as law enforcement, for example. But now there are enough of the right kind of people to warrant a new measuring stick, bodies with minds to match, essential, as we push out further and further.
Yet you still closely monitor performance.
We have to ensure that people are meeting their potential.
And exceeding it.
No one exceeds his potential.
If he did?
It would simply mean that we did not accurately gauge his potential in the first place.
I remembered the line from the Hindu scripture, the Bhagavad Gita, Vishnu. Is trying to persuade the prince that he should do his duty, and to impress him, takes on his multi-armed form and says, "Now I am become death, the destroyer of worlds." I suppose we all thought that one way or another.
Hello and welcome to the Return of the Repressed, dear listeners. Very happy, as always, to sit down on my Zafu and Zafuton and talk with you again. Very happy to read the comments about the Kammerer interlude. So glad. Initially, when the Patreon began, I was of course mostly excited about getting paid. But once that financial compensation started to resemble the meager salary I was last given to be a personal assistant, I started to remember that getting paid is just the unconscious side of one's production, and that getting minimum wage for taking care of those who need it the most was never why I did it. This was also the case when I worked half a year at a refugee camp on an island in Sweden during the Syrian crisis. And the same goes for the podcast and having worked on farms for no pay at all. Which are all cliché things to say, I know. But my slightly elaborated point might concern then what we might call compensation in a moneyless higher stage of communism, which would be a social currency of people letting me know from their hearts what they like and don't like about the product that I make. What else would I have? So in short, very inspiring, very exciting to hear your constructive critique and praise. I want to get inspired for future episodes by your assessments. Now, this episode is probably going to be way too long, so we really have to get into it. We have reached the 1930s after about three episodes or more of having focused on the Roaring Twenties. This will be fun and important. We will finally get into the heated debates, as the second half of the 30s is when Lysenko really starts experimenting and gets recognized for his work. But let's do some very quick recap to set the stage and remember how we got here. Well, when Kammerer died, the Koltsov-Serebrovsky clan and their neo-Darwinist, Weismannist, Morganist, Mendelian, etc. colleagues all over the world declared, as we know, the dawning of a new age. One which had surpassed the so-called naivety of Lamarck, and indeed the original Darwin. To emphasize environmental factors became Lamarckian, and Lamarckism was deemed pseudoscientific. With environmental explanatory models deprioritized, experimental biology and plant breeding now became obsessed with artificial mutations using carcinogens and radiation, which would eventually lead industrial agriculture to GMO monocropping. Further down the line. We also saw how the tone of the debates changed and how the elitist approach of the Serebrovsky-Koltsov clan started to throw around accusations of laymanship at anyone who didn't own or had access to an X-ray, the latest microscopes or lab conditions for fruit fly cultivation. Nonetheless, unlike the rest of the bourgeois scientific world, where even famous self-proclaimed leftists began to surrender to eugenics and genetics, abandoning the theory of acquired characteristics after Kammerer's suicide, at least the debates and the class struggle within theory did continue in the USSR. As talks erupted of Soviet Darwinism and Michurinism, and it caught on as a substantial movement among practicing botanists and agronomists, farmers, seed breeders, etc., towards the turn of the decade. At that time, a strategic maneuver was performed by Serebrovsky. His native followers, his Western informers and colleagues, as well as obscured patrons, decided to ditch Koltsov, who had too much dangerous baggage. After all, he had actually plotted and financed, towards the end and after the Civil War, that project of the Tactical Center, which sought to overthrow the Soviet Union. How he managed to escape the gulag and execution is almost a mystery, for he categorically refused to condemn his eugenic theories publicly as late as 1939, when he was criticized for having continued his work despite having been instructed to do the opposite more than a decade earlier. He would pass away a year later at the age of 68 in 1940 from a stroke, though some do say that he was poisoned by the NKVD, after having refused to give up his fascist theories. Thus his students and colleagues from the late 20s onwards began to see his conservative and over-orthodox theories, mannerism, and white connections as a loose cannon in the fight against not only the Michurinians but also fellow genetic reductionists who did not believe in eugenics. I mean, seriously, all the Koltsovian talk about the greater public being ants or termites, which were to be experimented upon by the prophets of the new religion, is enough to see how he was, you know, a bit too on the nose even for Serebrovsky, who nonetheless wanted to mass inseminate millions with Lenin's sperms and others' spunk from their genius seed bank during the first five-year plan. I actually don't know if they had a genius seed bank, but they seem to be talking about that, so maybe. Which is so weird. It's worse than collecting brains. Well, brains in vats or cranium is what I was thinking about, which was a popular thing at this time. And I mean, Galton had written a whole book, right, only about like an encyclopedia about people who he did consider geniuses, you know, not as a sort of retroactive remembrance, but more like a genome mapping of why there's still genius in the world today, making, you know, family connections and trying to trace, you know, the movement of the Aristogens, or he did probably have another word for that, but something similar, you know, they're all pretty much the same. So in reaction then to Soviet Darwinism and Michurinianism, they regrouped under a new banner called Socialist Eugenics, which, like the elitist slurs, started to appear more and more often in the public debates, not only in the Soviet Union, but also among some interesting characters of the international camp, primarily X-Ray Mueller, or Mueller, in the US, and his collaborator Julian Huxley in the UK. Through their propaganda work, it became possible to be a leftist and a eugenicist. We have already hinted in previous episodes that Huxley eventually managed to get Mueller into the Soviet Union to convert more followers and gather information on the opposition. We will learn just how they did that in episodes to come, but in today's episode we will note that the Michurinian opposition, the dialecticians who surrounded Lysenko, did not buy it. In their view, there was nothing really new in the quote-unquote new approach from that of the previous decades, quote-unquote Indiana methods, i.e. the forced sterilization promoted by Davenport and his phalang at Cold Spring Harbor. According to the Michurinian camp, quote-unquote socialist eugenics was simply a crypto version of that which was under development in the new Germany of the 1930s. For indeed, both kinds of eugenicists, as well as the geneticists who did not publicly agree with eugenics, the third, obscured kind, of the likes of Fruit Fly Morgan, received funding from the same world's biggest capitalists. This was even pointed out in a letter exchanged between Stalin and Lysenko after the war. I have tried to find the original letter from the late 40s leading up to the big Vasknil conference of 1949 on the situation in the biological sciences, but can only quote one of Lysenko's students who wrote, quote, having received Lysenko's letter and learned about Zhdanov's lecture, Stalin realized that things had gone too far, that Lysenko is about to be quote-unquote eaten, and the leadership of the country's agriculture will pass to quote within quotes, Rockefeller fellows, world-class Drosophila specialists, and improvers of the eugenic qualities of citizens. End of quote within quote. That is, it will fall apart. End of the quote in its entirety. There are many online versions of this book in Russian out there, and most of the times Rockefeller fellows is within quotes, suggesting these were the direct words of Stalin. A note further tells us that he is referring to some of our old friends, those in the eyes of Rockefeller, quote-unquote, ideologically promising, such as Levitt, Agol, and Jebrak, who trained with X-Ray Mueller in the US, as well as F. Dobazhansky and G. Karpechenko, who trained with Fruit Fly Morgan. We will focus today mainly on the class struggles of the 30s, but it should be noted these letters and internal discussions, recognizing the state of things, came in the late 40s, 2 decades after Lysenko began to make a name for himself in publications such as Pravda and Bednauta. And the first written documentation of Stalin to Lysenko of personally agreeing with the Michurinian camp, I believe, came as late as 1947. Quote, dear Yusuf Vissarionovich, if Michurin's theoretical principles, which we adhere to and develop on the basis of collective and state farm practice, are fundamentally correct, then the need has already become ripe for our governing bodies of education and agriculture to say their weighty words. To make a sharp change in the education of our cadres of biologists and agronomists and livestock breeders. The metaphysical doctrine of living bodies is Morganism-Mendelism. Weismannian neo-Darwinism is taught in all universities, while the Michurin doctrine, Soviet Darwinism, is taught almost nowhere. I ask you, Comrade Stalin, to help this good cause, which is necessary for our agriculture. End of the letter in its entirety. I mean, it's a longer letter, but those are the important points, right? Now, Stalin's response letter, written October 31, 1947, was favorable but vague. Quote, Dear Trofim Denisovich, I received your note dated 27X47. Thank you very much for your note. As for theoretical attitudes in biology, I believe that Michurin's attitude is the only scientific attitude. Weismannists and their followers, who deny the heredity of acquired properties, do not deserve to dwell on them at length. The future belongs to Michurin. Sincerely, I, Stalin. End of the letter in its entirety. Fearing that Lysenko's camp was about to be outmaneuvered by an international Rockefeller conspiracy, it's not a prime case of paranoia, either for the big mustachio or myself. N.L. Klementsov, professor at the Institute for the History and Philosophy of Science and Technology, University of Toronto, Canada, the Uzbekistan scholar whom you will remember from the sci-fi episode with the outlandish experiments of the 20s, arguably the contemporary foremost expert on Soviet biomedical science history in the West, having exclusively published books on that topic since the mid-90s, and who, just like Juravsky and other exiled academicians, do have ties to the CIA-financed Soviet paperclip programs of the Wilson Center and the Keenan Institute. Most of what I have read do have an anti-Stalinist tone, though not the usual generic gore kind. Nonetheless, he writes in a short Russian article that I managed to found and DeepL translated that, contrary to popular belief, quote, the process of restoring scientific ties with the West after the war was particularly successful in genetics, since there was still a recent history of close personal contacts, and unlike physics or mathematics, genetics was not involved in military research at this time. And therefore, the restoration of contacts between Soviet and Western geneticists did not attract much attention from the security services either in the USSR or in the West. During and immediately after the end of the war, Soviet genetics became a hot topic in the Western, especially scientific press. Western geneticists organized a widespread campaign against Lysenko in support of their Soviet colleagues. Why did the situation in Soviet genetics become so important for Western and especially American scientists? Question mark. Why did Western scientists, in the words of Dobazhansky, quote within quote, take this situation so to heart? End of the quote within quote. During the war, Western geneticists received information about Soviet genetics and geneticists through various channels, official, including diplomatic, and private. Another opportunity to supplement information about Soviet genetics presented itself at the anniversary of the USSR Academy of Sciences. In June 1945, the Soviet government celebrated the 220th anniversary of the founding of the Academy with great pomp. Stalin personally ordered that scientific delegations from allied countries, especially the USA, Great Britain, France, and Canada, be invited to the festivities. The government covered all expenses and provided the participants with unprecedented comfort. Minister of Foreign Affairs, first deputy head of government, V.M. Molotov, raised a toast, quote, to the development of close cooperation between Soviet and foreign science, end of quote, within quote. Julian Huxley, who had already visited the USSR in 1931 and was familiar with many Soviet biologists, visited all genetic laboratories in Moscow and Leningrad and met with all leading Soviet geneticists. Huxley and Ashby, and you should remember Ashby as the sidekick of Huxley, also listened to a special lecture, which at their request was given by Lysenko during the anniversary. Upon his return to England, Huxley published a laudatory review of the achievements of Soviet researchers in evolutionary biology and genetics, and shared his impressions of Russian genetics and geneticists with his colleagues in several confidential letters. Another source of information about Russian genetics for Western scientists was A.R. Żebrak, who you will recall already had a Rockefeller scholarship. Ernst Babcock invited him to give a lecture at the Department of Genetics at the University of California at Berkeley. What is it with the Anglos, man? I don't get it. Why do you call Richards dicks? And why do so many people have cock in their name? Marcus, you do know that like the first written account of Viking stories and lore is written by a man named Little Dick. It's not little, it's just Dicky. Yeah, Dicky. Oh, the fathers. Okay. Can we go on? His name is coming back. Are you 5 years old? Go on. Apparently, at Żebrak's request, this event was arranged very officially. Babcock. Shut up. Babcock asked the university president to send a formal invitation through the Soviet consulate in San Francisco. And here's another quote within the quote. At first glance, this may seem unnecessary to you, but if you allow me to explain very briefly the situation in genetics in the USSR, it's currently very critical. A group has come to power that is trying to discredit what can be called quote-unquote, orthodox genetics. So again, we see they are already referring to themselves or agreeing to refer to themselves as this. Since Dr. Żebrak fully supports scientific genetics and is trying to fight the opposing group mentioned above, it would be very important for him to know that our invitation was officially supported by you. Mm-hmm. End of the quote within the quote. And I'll just add, we can guess why it is important for the invitation, because they want to make it look like, you know, something like what was the confidentiality of, you know, Huxley's personal letters, for example. I'll go on. The picture will become clearer and clearer. After the conference, Żebrak planned to spend several weeks in the United States visiting various genetic laboratories. This plan, however, failed. Immediately after the end of the conference, Żebrak was recalled to Moscow. However, he succeeded in his mission, restoring contacts with American geneticists and disseminating information about Soviet genetics. The essence of Żebrak's quote-unquote negotiations, and I mean, this is Kremenzov who is putting the air quotes here, or I'm doing the air quotes, he put it into his text, with his colleagues is clear from Lerner's letter to G. Meller, quote within quote, pretty soon Lysenko will have enough rope to hang himself. In the current situation, the support of American geneticists is extremely important. End of quote, end quote. The news brought by Żebrak, as well as the results of the negotiations between Ashby and Huxley in the USSR, were immediately spread among members of the Western genetics community. American geneticists used their well-established communication network. As soon as one of them received a letter with any valuable information, he immediately sent it to all other members of the community. For example, when the English geneticist Pius Koller sent Milislav Demerek a letter on the state of genetic research in post-war Europe, the latter sent out more than 40 copies of this letter to colleagues. Any news about Soviet genetics spread extremely quickly through this network. Western geneticists took a number of actions to help their Russian colleagues and organized a broad anti-Lysenko campaign. Four of the most famous American geneticists, Dunn, Demirek, Dobashansky, and Mueller, led the American part of the campaign, while Huxley coordinated the quote-unquote British front. End of the quote in its entirety. Now, the reason why Krementsov is telling us all this is a slip of the tongue made possible by the unconscious conviction that this was a noble fight. Despite the clearly extra scientific measures in establishing a world scientific consensus. And if the modus operandi of intelligence gathering among the Western geneticists feels reminiscent of some kind of aspiring, then it is about time that I reveal that Julian Huxley wasn't just the head of UNESCO. He had also worked for the British Intelligence Corp, i.e. MI6 stuff. His position was, interestingly enough, considering his role in this century-long story of obscuration, at the censor's office. Furthermore, the vast majority of the Anglo-American geneticists were also eugenicists, and many of them had kept up secret contact with their German colleagues during the war. All this considered, it is perhaps better to think of the international eugenics movement as being split between social fascist and classical fascist phalanx, though generally a split of a rhetorical nature, as they ultimately believe in the same thing and seek to control the perceived problem by similar means, of which Swedish social democracy, the freest world place in the world, is perhaps the best example, as we will begin to see a glimpse of in this episode, but also in our other upcoming series on the skull measurers. We will, of course, elaborate on this part of the story when we reach the 40s, but let's get back to the 30s and the early formation of this post-war situation in biological science. You just heard was a small preview of the fifth installment of the second season of the Echo Fascism series, in which I try together with you to trace not only the tradition of the Michurinist and the person that is Lysenko, but it is also a story of how our contemporary genetic paradigm or narrative came to be. I had to buy a lot of old books to make these episodes or this series happen. So if you want to know more, and if you want to listen to the rest of this episode and the many others that make up this series, then please head on over to the Patreon and sign up for a small sum. You will also be given access to other series about for example, the murder of Prime Minister Palme in Sweden, and the long history of cannabis and how that was moved away from agroecological possibilities. Thank you for listening so far, and I hope to see you on the Patreon. Take care.